This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
I want to begin with a personal question for the both of you. We, of course, have been born and raised in a different paradigm. And for us, the reality of Gaza, the Palestinian people, has been a part of our identity since our youth. I mean, there's never been a cognitive dissonance, there's never been an alternative worldview. But for the both of you, you had to overcome a different paradigm. You had to understand that what you were taught was incorrect. And then there must have been a personal cost as well, in which perhaps your family, your friends are surprised at your transition to a different understanding. So, and it requires an act of courage and bravery. So whatever you're willing to share, the question is to both of you. Firstly, how did that come about? As much personal as you want to get. And secondly, whatever you want to share with us, how did your family and friends receive this? Because it must have been very awkward and painful. And here you are at the forefront of the Palestinian cause. I cannot even begin to imagine your personal trajectories and journey. So whatever you're willing to share, you know, whoever wants to go first. Oh, turn it on. There we go. Okay.
Thank you for that question. In my case, I was raised with this belief that Israel is my homeland. And at some point, what occurred to me was that you have many millions of Palestinians around the world whose parents and grandparents are from Palestine, were born and raised in Palestine, speak Arabic, have a strong connection to their homeland, and yet they cannot go to Palestine. They are prevented from entering Palestine because they're of the incorrect religion. They're of the incorrect ethnicity. Whereas me, an American Jew, who may or may not speak a word of Hebrew or Arabic, who may or may not know anyone in the country, have no family connections, I have a right to go there. I have a birthright because it's my homeland. That made no sense to me. Absolutely no sense. And what occurred to me in the course of many, many dialogues with many, many Palestinians over the course of many years was that this was a tremendous injustice. And that was the first, domino to fall. The second for me was, as a historian, as someone who spent many, many years studying the history, the more you study the history of Zionism, the more you realize how deeply, deeply unethical and racist the movement was. I mean, the whole concept of the movement was, how do we create a Jewish state in a land that is 90-95% non-Jewish? And so we're going to move to Palestine and evict the native inhabitants because they're non-Jewish. And then we're going to hire only Jews, because the whole concept is we're building a Jewish state where we're going to employ Jews only. It was a concept called Jewish labor. And the more you study, I mean, we could talk about this for hours. I'll wrap up there. But the more you study about the history of Zionism, the more you realize from beginning to end, the project was deeply, deeply unethical. They talked for decades and decades in the 1920s and 30s and 40s about the concept of transfer. Oh, but guess what transfer translates to in 2024? It's called ethnic cleansing. But they talked about it openly. We have to transfer the Arabs. Oh, it's going to benefit them. I mean, so the more you study the history, the more pro-Palestine you become. And then just as to the second question, look, I paid a huge personal price. You know, my whole family is crazy Zionist. They support Israel in every imaginable way, and I have paid a tremendous price. But here's what I will say. I feel like I've also benefited in so many ways. I mean, just seeing all these amazing people here building so many connections with Muslims and Palestinians and Arabs and people of conscience, you pay a price on the one hand, but then you experience the hospitality and the solidarity of the Palestine community. So it's you pay a price, but you also experience this incredible joy and connection and solidarity with all people of conscience. Wow.
Yeah. Well, that was great. That was really great, Zach. Yeah. So my story is a little bit different because I grew up inside it. So all of these things that Zach was talking about, I grew up on the inside of that. So members of my family were they're the ones who were executing this insane vision of building a state for Jewish people in the country that belongs to somebody else. And so my experience obviously was different because when you're in it, I thought I was living in a country called Israel. I had no idea that I was actually in Palestine until much later. And my experience didn't come, so first of all, to me, Zionism is not something that I had to study. To me, Zionism was what I heard every single day at the dinner table. That's the only thing that was ever discussed. The state, the Jewish state, the Zionist state, Zionism, the state, and how we make the state stronger and how we contribute to the state. That was everything. It was a very patriotic, quote unquote, patriotic upbringing. So for me, it took a terrible tragedy to have my worldview all shaken up. And sadly, I think that happens quite often, that we're forced to divorce from our core beliefs and what we believe are our values and things we hold dear and kind of review them. It's usually because, very often it's because of a terrible tragedy. So that was my case. My sister's little girl was killed in a suicide mission in Jerusalem by Palestinians, of course. So that was the drive to re-examine everything. And then in terms of courage and paying the price, I wouldn't categorize what I've done as courage. I appreciate the sentiment, but I didn't risk anything. And I didn't lose anything. So some people who were my friends no longer speak to me. I don't see that as a loss. If they maintain their racist views, then that's their problem. Family is always complicated. So in my family, we have the entire range. Currently, my family members, most of them don't speak to me. But again, that's the process that's part of, they choose to be racist. That's their decision. And I agree with Zach, the benefits of being involved in this work, the gains, the relationships of being involved on this with this issue are enormous. They're beyond any, words can't even begin to describe the connections, the generosity. And really, in my case, the transformation is thanks to a very large degree to the generosity of the Palestinian community where I was living at the time, which is in San Diego, in Southern California. It was their generosity and their welcoming of me and allowing me to go through this process that they were my support in a way. Nobody ever accused me. Nobody ever pointed a finger at me or anything like that. It was always a very generous, very welcoming, very supportive. And that's how I was able to do that. So that was my process. That's what I went through.
You know, I believe I express a sentiment on behalf of all of us that we are really in awe of the both of your courage and bravery. I mean, you're both coming from a place of power and privilege and connections and government. And you have, as you said, the authority and the right to go back and have a place in that land. And yet the both of you gave up at great personal cost. And even some of you, your careers and others have been affected as well. And you're here on the correct side, which happens to be our side, but you're here having given up privilege, power, certain careers, wealth, family connections. And the only reason you're doing this is because you want to stand on the side of truth and because the purity of your sincerity is more precious to you than the corruption of politics and whatever the other side is offering. So on behalf of all of us, really, we're very grateful, and we ask, you know, God to protect you and to guide you and to benefit the community through you. So another round of applause for them. Now, as I go through our questions, there is a common sentiment, no exaggeration, at least 30 questions, roughly the same. I'm just going to phrase them all in one. And again, the question is to the both of you. There's literally like 50 questions here, 30 are exactly the same, but different wording. And that is, there's a sense of great frustration. 1 year has gone by. Nothing we've done has seemed to work. So we're asking the both of you, what specifically can we do? Given the fact that we are not politicians, we are not, you know, multi-billionaires, we don't have, you know, the connections, we're just your average, you know, Muslim American citizen, there's a sense of great frustration. So we're turning to you for your guidance. What specific strategies can you advise us to do about bringing about a change and ending the genocide? And again, the questions to the both of you.
There is no right or wrong way to be an activist. It's very situational, depending on your position in life. I would also say that we learned over this past election cycle that change does not happen primarily at the ballot box. It happens if you're a student on your college campus, where your university is almost certainly invested in companies profiting off Israel's occupation, ethnic cleansing, apartheid, and now genocide. If you're a student, that means you can be involved in the BDS movement on campus, in the encampments, encouraging your university to divest from those companies. Maybe you work at a company, maybe that company is Amazon and hosts the cloud services of the Israeli army. Maybe you can advocate within your company to help your company divest from those investments and those initiatives. Maybe you're just in a community like this, or you have family and friends who may not be bought in. Perhaps in this room, that's probably less likely to be the case. But maybe at your workplace, you have colleagues and who are not aware, who do not know what is happening. Maybe online, you have an audience and a following you can speak about what is happening online. Education is so important. It starts with education. Maybe you live close to an Elbit factory and you can go protest and prevent those manufacturing companies from physically sending the weapons and the drones and the bombs to kill innocent people. So there's no right or wrong way to be an activist. I think what we can all do is embrace the call to boycott, divest, and sanction Israel. That is a very personal thing that we can all do. With our own purchasing power, we can decide what we spend money on, what we support, what products we buy, what companies we support with our own wallet and our own pocketbooks. That is something everyone can do. But let's remember, social change and activism, these things happen very slowly. The Civil Rights Act of 1965, that's more than 60 years ago, okay? Black people in the United States were legally equal on paper. And look at what we saw in 2020. Look at the George Floyd movement. Look at Black Lives Matter. It took 60 years. And we still do not have equality in this country. This is a slow process. And it's gradual. And change does not happen at the ballot box. It happens at the dinner table conversations. It happens at the university campuses. It happens in the workplace.
I was at an event in a masjid yesterday also in Houston, and a very similar question was asked. It was framed slightly different. It was framed as how do we respond to this enormous power that the other side has? And I think the answer is, I agree with everything that was just said, of course. I think it goes back to us being absolutely truthful and not shying away or being afraid to tell the truth. We have to be absolutely truthful and unapologetically truthful. The other side, either people don't know the truth, maybe they were, you know, in this country, the education system is a Zionist education system. People graduate from high school, they are Zionists. They don't know it perhaps, but that's what they know. You know, if you ask people on the street, if you say Palestine, they confuse it with Pakistan half the time. And if they do know anything about Palestine, then it's very superficial. But if you say Israel, oh yes, of course, we know Israel, we love Israel, we support, you know, that sort of thing. That's the response. Americans receive a Zionist education, and that's one of the strengths of the Zionist movement, that they were able to do that. They were able to influence education in this country, among many other things. So we suddenly show up to people who were raised as Zionists in this country, and we say, well, you have to boycott Israel. Of course they think we're anti-Semitic. Based on what they know, calling to boycott and divest and impose sanctions on the only Jewish state must be anti-Semitic. So it's up to us to provide the context, because they don't have it. Now, things are so extreme right now that we don't really have time to educate all of Americans. That's why in my organization, Palestine House of Freedom, we are in Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill, because those are the people we want to focus on, the decision makers and the people that work around them. But nothing can replace our being absolutely resolute and truthful about the truth, unapologetic about the truth, unapologetic about our support for Palestine, for Palestinians. That's the only thing I think that's the most powerful tool that we have, is that we know the truth. They have a lot of money, the other side, and they have nothing else. So they build lies upon lies, and they're very quick with the lies. I mean, I don't know if you probably heard about what happened in Amsterdam. Boom, I mean, they came out with lies so fast that I was confused. I thought something else happened, that they were talking about, you know what I mean? They were so fast. I mean, a former Israeli prime minister, all these people were like on social media going, wow. So the only response is that we know the truth, and we have to use that tool, and we have to educate at the workplace, on our platforms, like Zach was saying, in every possible way. And also to remind people, almost 3 years ago, Amnesty International published a report on the apartheid in Palestine. Check it out. Everybody should check it out and then refer to that. Say, look, Amnesty International came out almost 3 years ago with a report that very few people use. We use it a lot. We use it in our social media to demonstrate, you know, that apartheid is not something that somebody invented because they're anti-Semitic. The term apartheid is a legal term. It's a crime that's defined in international law. And Amnesty International, after years of work on the ground, came out with a very, very comprehensive report demonstrating that crime, the crime of apartheid, is being perpetrated in Palestine for almost 8 decades. And at the end of the report, there are recommendations. So one of the things that I've been doing is encouraging organizations and groups to adopt the report. Adopt the report as an organization, as a... you know, as a Muslim society, as a whatever organization you're part of. Because when you adopt the report, first of all, you have to read it, right? And so the leaders of the community, the leaders of the organization read it. But then at the end of the report, there are recommendations as to what needs to be done. What do we do as individuals, as organizations, as states, when the crime is being perpetrated? And it has to do with sanctions, it has to do with divestment, and so on. So that gives a whole different structure to that. So tell the truth and then use the information that we have at our disposal to share that with other people.
Thank you very much. So by the way, just a quick comment. The most upvoted comment right now is that Miko and Zachary, sorry to hear about your situation, but we are all your family. So we're all welcoming you to our greater family as well. Okay. So a question for you, Zachary, and that is, I guess it's a two-part. Firstly, How do religious Jews reconcile the fact that according to their theology, the state of Israel should only be founded after the Messiah? And then secondly, how do we then talk to religious Jews about the evils of Zionism, given that it is intertwined with their theology?
Yeah, this is a great question. Just like Christianity and Islam, there are many, many different types of religious Jews. You have anti-Zionist religious Jews, you have non-Zionist religious Jews, you have Zionist religious Jews. And because the Jewish tradition is so rich, there's so many different historical, theological trends you can pull from, base your argument on, that you can argue from a religious perspective that actually, no, Zionism is part of the prophetic tradition, and that by moving to Israel, you are actually carrying out God's will and in accordance with halakha of Jewish law. You have lots of rabbinical authorities over the past century that have come to that conclusion. Of course, you have 1900 years of tradition before that, of halakhic authorities before that, that all call that a heresy. So, just like every other religious tradition, Jewish religious authorities are divided on this question today. What I would say is that for many, many hundreds, if not thousands of years, you know, Jews lived in exile. They lived scattered across the four corners of the world. And it was for that reason that it was absolutely critical for those Jewish authorities to embrace the exile, because we want to be equal wherever we are. We're always going to be scattered around the world. But, you know, so of course we have to advocate for equality within those countries and those empires and those regimes. And so basically Jewish theology developed as a result of that. And statism as a perspective was rejected overwhelmingly. And then what happened was, because of the secular Zionists, who were almost, for the most part, atheists, they had no commitment to Jewish tradition. I mean, in fact, that was one of the reasons they became Zionists, because they rejected traditional Judaism. But because they established a state in 48, Jewish religious authorities followed suit and began to explain how the state was somehow some fulfillment, some biblical prophecy. But I'm not here to tell you what the right version of Judaism is and what the wrong version of Judaism is. I'm here to tell you that equality before the law, the rule of law, human rights law, international humanitarian law, international law, These are the principles that we should all embrace. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, this is what we should embrace. I don't care what kind of Jew you are or what your theology is. It's those things you need to focus on, and that is irrespective of what your religious orientation is.
Miko, a question comes about: what is the best strategy to counter AIPAC lobbying? And is there a lobbying on the side of the Palestinians or the Muslims that you would recommend, or other tactics? So it's the lobbying, political lobbying issues.
You know, before I answer that, I want to say a word about the previous question.
Sure.
Kind of. So over the last several years, I've been researching working on a book about this community of ultra-Orthodox Jews that were anti-Zionist, and why is this large community of the most observant Jews, why did they reject Zionism and why did they reject the State of Israel? And I was born and raised in Jerusalem in a neighborhood neighboring their neighborhoods. But, you know, we didn't talk to them. We looked down at them because they were religious and so on. So over the last few years, I've been working and speaking and staying at their homes and so on, mostly in communities around New York State, in London, in the UK, and in Palestine, in Jerusalem, to understand deeply what it is that they're rejecting and how does it make sense that Jews would reject the idea of a Jewish state. And Jews rejected the idea of sovereignty. So if Palestine, or the way it's referred to in Judaism, the land of Israel is a holy land, it's meant for worship, not for sovereignty. So the idea of sovereignty is completely rejected. And one of the things we're seeing today And I think this is really, really important. One of the things we're seeing today is tens of thousands of young ultra-Orthodox Jews rejecting the call to serve in the Israeli army. And they used to be exempt, now they changed the law, so they're out there by the thousands protesting, and they're being arrested. And this has been going on for several years. I was in Palestine and Jerusalem a couple of years ago interviewing some of these anti-draft activists, and they're living in hiding because the authorities are looking for them. They want to arrest them. So if you meet them, you have to meet them like at midnight in some alley and some behind some bookstore. And, you know, I mean, it's very, very, you know, it's a completely covert operation. And when they're confronted with Zionists, because the Zionists will say to them, you know, Hamas wants to kill you too. Hezbollah wants to kill you too. How come you don't want to serve in the army? And they say, we never wanted a state. We came here to worship. We're here to worship. You wanted a state. This is your problem. We're not part of this problem. We didn't create this problem. You did. And it's very telling to see these young ultra-Orthodox Jews, very young men, say this to the Zionists who are coming to them and saying, you have to serve in this army. So this is your army. This is not our army. We're Jewish people. We don't carry arms. We don't do this. We don't steal and we don't kill. It's part of our religion, you know, not to kill and not to steal. So I think it's very, very important to understand that. And another thing that I did several times, you know, the Haram al-Sharif, the Al-Aqsa compound, these Zionist Orthodox Jews, which is a new kind of a mutation, they go there and they have these tours and they, you know, by the thousands. So I would get in line and walk up with them just to hear what they're saying and to see what's going on. And I remember standing in line, and this is to your point about the different rabbis. So they look and pretend that they are Orthodox Jews, these settlers. But the tours, everybody, a lot of people take, a lot of Israelis go on these tours. And as you wait to go up, because they only let a certain number of people at a time, there are other Orthodox Jews saying, what are you doing? This is forbidden. This is forbidden. It's forbidden for Jews to enter the compound because it's a holy ground. And Jews for millennia have been prohibited from entering that space. And they're saying, no, we have our own rabbis. Our rabbis say it's fine. So these are new kind of settler, colonizer rabbis who decided that it was okay, that have Zionized Judaism. So that's kind of an interesting process. So I just thought I'd mention that because I've been working on that, of kind of experiencing that. In terms of a response to AIPAC, again, this goes back to organizing. This goes back to creating a strategy, a winning strategy. And I've said this to Palestinian friends, and people don't always like to hear this, but the truth is the Zionists had a winning strategy very early on. And they were willing to put away their differences. You know, some were socialists, some were conservatives, some were this, some were that. But on the issue of a Jewish state, they're willing to set aside their differences and align and work together. And they had a winning strategy. We don't have a winning strategy. And this is nobody's fault. I'm not blaming Palestinians. I'm not blaming anyone. But the reality is that there isn't a sense that there's a singular goal that we're all working towards. People still talk about two-state solution, which is an absolute madness, in my opinion. So one of the advantages that we've had right now since we started Palestine House of Freedom is that we are working together. Different organizations are coming, discussing, conferring with one another on how to create this and how to, first of all, unify around a single goal, which is a free Palestine with equal rights on all of historic Palestine. And a second part is a strategy to get there, because there's never been one. This group did this, and this group did that, and this group did this, and this group did that, and the conversation has not been singular. So that's a challenge that we have. That's on us. And sadly, it's taken this horror that we've seen in Gaza over the last year to bring us together closer and to talk about this. But So the good news is we're working on it. The reality is that the traditional politics don't work for us. With traditional politics, you have to have a lot of money and you have to be corrupt. We need to figure out a way, and I have this written on my in my office. We need to come up with creative strategies to circumvent traditional politics so that we end up sitting at the table, so we get a seat at the table where decisions are being made, because right now we're excluded. And so this may be a long answer, but the reality is that we're not anywhere near having a strategy, that creative strategy that will allow us to circumvent traditional politics. We're not there yet. We all need to put our heads together, and that means everybody in this room as well, and many other spaces that, you know, where this conversation takes place, in order to unite around a strategy. And they're wonderful organizations that do tremendous work on Palestine, of course, everywhere. It would be great if we could, you know, once we have a singular strategy and we are focused on a particular goal, I think things will move much faster. So that's the answer. We're not there yet, but that's what needs to happen for us to be able to provide an answer and to stand, you know, to stand, have a solid stance to oppose AIPAC and to oppose the Zionist propaganda.
You heard it straight from Miko's mouth. It's something that I've been saying, and so many clerics and preachers and teachers have been saying. It's not that complicated. Unity, vision, strategy. It is so sad that we as a community are still divided. And you heard it straight from Mr. Miko Pile's mouth. No matter what the disagreements of the other group are, when it comes to Israel, they are united. Wallahi, it is a shame that the Ummah cannot be united for Gaza and Palestine. It is a shame. We need to be united in spite of our sectarianism. Forget about sectarianism. Forget about our divisions amongst ourselves. Forget about our different ethnicities. Forget about anywhere, anything else. There's a genocide going on. If they can unite for power and wealth, we can unite to defend the innocent. And we have to do so. So inshallah, we hope one of the biggest positives that come out of this negative Gaza, it will force us to raise the bar amongst ourselves and to unite and to have that unified strategy. So thank you very much, Mr. Miko, for that. Zachary, a question for you. Can you elaborate more on the reality of Christian Zionism? And why would Christians be Zionist, and what role it plays in the overall Zionist strategy or alliance?
So, as I talked about at some length, Zionism was a Christian ideology before it was a Jewish ideology. And it started with the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, when Christian leaders in Europe rejected church authority and said, we need to read the Bible literally, and we need to memorize the stories of the Bible. And that led eventually to this new eschatological fantasy about Jews congregating in the Holy Land at the end of days. And that led to the political movement of European Christians in England in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, calling for a Jewish state in Palestine. And that same theological movement, those same beliefs, are held by people like John Hagee, who is the founder and president of Christians United for Israel, the organization 10 million strong today, that is the primary Christian evangelical support for the state of Israel. And again, it has to do with these theological beliefs, these eschatological beliefs about Jews ingathering at the end of days, there'll be a rupture, Jesus will return to planet Earth, and there will be human redemption. And I'm not a Christian theologian, so I'm not going to get more in-depth than that. But that is the basic theology. And if you ask an average evangelical American Christian today, why do you support Israel? They'll just cite Genesis and tell you, you know, God gave Israel to the Jews, or to Abraham and his offspring, who are the modern day Jewish people, which is obviously nonsense. But that is the belief. And it's not really much deeper than that. I mean, obviously plenty of people will cite you all kinds of theological explanations, but for the average evangelical American, that is what it comes down to. And it's also wrapped up in these very racist, very orientalist, very bigoted views about the Orient and Muslims and Arabs being backwards, and it's tied into that. And this belief that, oh, the Jews, they need a homeland, and the Arabs, well, they're all just Arabs. Why don't they just go to Jordan or Syria or Egypt? It's all wrapped up in this very, you know, Judeo-Christian-centric view of the world that puts Christians and Jews above Muslims. And, you know, maybe I'll pause there and feel free to add anything, but...
Thank you very much. Thank you. So, Miko, this is an awkward question. It's up to you how much you want to go or you want to just pass. It's fine as well. But what are your views on the Trump presidency, and do you think anything's going to change under his administration? It's up to you if you want to pass it.
Well, I think it's an interesting question. A lot of people ask that, and I think our issue is unique. I think, you know, our issue is unique. I know that on many, many other issues, immigration, asylum seekers, women's rights, religious rights, on and on and on, his presidency promises dark days. On our issue, either way, we were facing dark days. So we need to just continue pushing forward as hard as we can. And I think that on this particular issue, if we look at other examples historically, when the conversation shifts, it shifts across the board. So if we take South African apartheid, for example, one day it was okay to support apartheid. The next day, nobody was supporting apartheid, and everybody claimed Nelson Mandela is their hero. It was across the board. And I think, I mean, nobody knows how soon Palestine is going to be free, but I wouldn't put it past the possibility that it could be Donald Trump president when Palestine is free. I mean, I know it sounds completely crazy at this moment, but I think that if we push hard enough, once the conversation shifts, and that's really key, to shift the conversation, particularly in Washington, D.C., from a completely pro-Israel, pro-genocide, to dismantling apartheid and establishing a free Palestine. But it could be under a Trump administration. If we push hard enough, if we do everything that we can do, then again, once the conversation shifts, it'll shift across the board. I mean, it was Ronald Reagan who eventually, you know, was the president when the United States decided to boycott apartheid South Africa. So it's not, you know, it sounds crazy, but I don't think it's an impossibility. It's really up to us to push as hard as we can to bring the shift in the conversation on Palestine. You know, if there was a different president elected, I don't think we would have had to work any less hard in order to accomplish the same thing. So on this issue, you know, that's my response.
Thank you. So back to you, Zachary. Question for you. Is there any, or do you have any statistics on what percentage of Jewish people identify as Zionist, pro-Zionist, anti-Zionist? And also, can you tell us about the Natura Cartae, and would it be useful for us to ally with them or push them as an alternative?
Well, I think Miko just said he's writing a book about them, so maybe I'll let him answer that part of the question. But as to the first part of the question around American Jews and what percentage are Zionist,
pro-anti,
there have been some very interesting polls that have come out in the past few years. There was a poll that came out in 2022 in which something like 30% of American Jewish millennials or younger described Israel as an apartheid state. I think today that number would probably be more like 40 or 50%. We're talking about Jews, let's say, under 40, 45. Obviously, the case is different for the older generations. As for genocide, I think the most recent poll I saw was something like 30% of American Jews, all American Jews, describe what Israel's doing in Gaza as a genocide. We already said 77% of Democrats support an arms embargo on Israel, and Jews are 80% Democrat, or 75% Democrat. I saw another poll that came out not so long ago. I think 40%, something like 40% of American Jews also support an arms embargo on Israel. So again, the key question is what age are we talking about? What age group are we talking about? The divide is not Jewish, non-Jewish, it's generational. Young American Jews are just as pro-Palestine as non-Jews. Go around to the college campuses where you had encampments. Everywhere you go, they were having Sukkot. They were building a sukkah on the college campus, encampment at Harvard, at Princeton. You know, Jews are some of the most actively, I mean, maybe as a percentage of total Jews, they're still sort of in the minority of American Jews, but they are the most vocal of any American group. I would, by the way, include Muslims and Arabs in this group. The American anti-Zionist Jews are the most vocal. They take over train stations. They take over bridges. They took over the tundra on Capitol Hill. They are the most active and the most vocal and the loudest because they see what is being perpetrated in their name is so horrifying that this genocide is being carried out somehow in the name of defending Jews. It is absolutely horrifying to us. And so I think there is a very strong movement, especially among young Jews, who are calling for change.
And the Natura Cartae?
And the Natura Cartae. I mean, look, what was the exact question?
Like, should we ally with them? Or are they, who are they? We don't really know much about them, but they seem...
I mean, Miko, please jump in here. But, you know, look, Natura Cartae, I mean, this is some of the most vocal social justice activists, period. I mean, they sacrificed everything. You know, these people, for them, you know, we have a tradition in Judaism. I mean, someone actually just came up to me earlier and said there's a very similar tradition in Islam, which I was not aware of. But if you save one life, you save the entire world. We have the exact same concept in Judaism. You know, Rabbi Akiva in Pirkei Avot was asked, summarize all of the entire Torah standing on one foot. He said, you know, treat others like you want to be treated. That's the entirety of the Torah in four words. Okay, so there's a very strong tradition in the Jewish community. I mean, supporting human rights. I mean, Abraham Joshua Heschel stood alongside Martin Luther King Jr., marching for equality for all. And Natura Cartae is exactly the same. You know, these are the most active, the most outspoken people for Palestine. So absolutely, form alliances, build bridges with them.
MashaAllah, excellent, thank you.
I would just add, I mean, absolutely, but yeah, I would add just some historical context. So, kind of like what you were saying, when it became obvious. So let me start from the beginning. So when Zionism emerged at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, across the board, Jews rejected it. In the 1900, a group of major rabbis came out with a booklet, with a manifesto, in which they were warning Jewish people of the dangers of Zionism, the dangers of a Jewish state. And basically they said three things. A Jewish state will bring violence to the Holy Land. It will ruin the good relations between Jews and Muslims and Jews and Arabs. And will cast doubt as to the loyalty of Jews who live as a religious minority everywhere across the world. In other words, it's bad news for Jewish people. And certainly the Jewish community in Palestine rejected the notion of a Jewish state completely, to the point that when the Jewish state was established, they were begging the United Nations to give them a special status so they wouldn't have to be citizens of the state, which they rejected. Now, in the mid-1930s, there were parts of the Jewish community in Palestine that thought, well, we reject this idea, but maybe we should work with them since they are Jews. And that's when Natura Cartae was formed. Natura Cartae is Aramaic for the guardians of the city. So they see themselves as guardians of Judaism. And they said, absolutely not. We will not discuss, we will not negotiate, we will not have anything, any part of Zionism. Today, all these years later, Natura Cartae are the activists. I mean, they're a small group compared to the entirety of ultra-Orthodox Jews. Ultra-Orthodox Jews are by and large not Zionist or anti-Zionist. Natura Cartae are the fighters. They're the activists. They're the ones who show up. And absolutely align. I mean, they go everywhere. besides the fact that they've been to Gaza and they've been to Lebanon and they've been to Yemen and they go to Iran and they speak with everyone, they show up to protest, rain or shine. And they are incredibly courageous. So absolutely aligning with them. And there's so many, you know, there's so many places where, you know, the real Jewish, you know, observant Jews, the laws that they follow, the traditions they follow are so similar to Islam. The places where the two religions are so close, it's obvious these two religions are sister religions. That absolutely, I think they're wonderful allies for Palestine. And I remind people that they've been standing for Palestine long before any of us did. You know, they've been standing for Palestine and demanding and rejecting the idea of Zionist sovereignty in Palestine long before, you know, most of us even thought in that direction. So absolutely, they're wonderful allies.
Thank you very much. And on a personal anecdote, so as you're aware, when we had the DC March for Palestine, around 500,000 people showed up, and I was speaking there. And so when I was speaking, there was at least like 300 of the Natura Carta, you know, because they dress like Orthodox Jews. They have their turbans, or what do you call it? The strimal. They had that on. So I asked, like, who are these people? They said, oh, the Natura Carta here. And they had to walk because it was a Sabbath, the Saturday. They had to walk because they're not allowed to take the car there. And over 300 of them came, including their chief rabbi in America. They came in to attend the protest on our side. And they're having banners, Jews for Israel and Jews for peace and Jews against Zionism. So if you watch my video, which is on YouTube, I actually changed my script and I added a paragraph praising. And I said, these are the real followers of Moses. These are the real people who love God and are showing the, you know, the laws of the Torah. So definitely, you know, they're definitely our allies here.
I'll say one more thing, if I may.
Sure.
On November 21st, one of the rabbis, Rabbi Feldman, who is one of the leaders of the Natura Carta in the U.S., is coming to our Palestine House of Freedom in D.C., and we're going to do an event where he will be discussing how, or explaining how, rejecting Zionism is not anti-Semitic, it's quite the opposite, you know, because Zionism is an affront to Judaism. And that we also have a YouTube channel, Palestine House of Freedom, so we're going to post it on there as well. So just so you know, that conversation is coming up.
Okay, thank you. Inshallah, we go for another 10 minutes or so, and then inshallah, wrap it up. So next question, I don't know who to ask amongst us, so whoever wants to take this question. It's an interesting one. How do you explain the complete unprofessionalist behavior of the IDF soldiers on social media and their postings? Do they have no military censorship, or is there an actual strategy to indicate their barbarity? And you're aware of what we're talking about, the idea of posting, you know, the types of stuff that they post, which is absolutely despicable. So somebody's wondering, is this a tactic, or what is going on? How can they just get away with this? Whoever wants to take that, I don't know.
Well, the only way to explain it is, you know, if you take, you know, gangsters, that operate with impunity. They're not afraid of any authority. There's no law, there's no authority that holds them accountable. They will become worse and worse and worse. They will, and they flaunt their crimes in public, because why not? It's a gangster mentality. I mean, the entire Israeli response to what happened on October 7th is a gangster mentality. They were defeated, they're humiliated on October the 7th. So what does a gangster do? They find the weakest victim and they unleash their wrath and their vengeance on that victim that is defenseless. And that's what we've seen in Gaza over the last year. And then since, again, they can act with impunity, no one is holding them accountable, then we see this insane you know, behavior, and they're not shy about it. The other thing is, I think people overrate, there's a tendency to overrate the military prowess of the Israeli army. The Israeli army is nothing but a glorified gang. It's a glorified gangsters, really. The battles and wars that they were victorious were battles and wars against largely either non-military civilians, like in 1948, the Nakba. Now it's been happening, suppressing Palestinian resistance. And even when they fought other armies, they knew for a fact, and I think I said this when I was here last time, I talked about it, they knew for a fact that they were going to win because the other side was not prepared and these were armies that were easily defeatable. So they've never actually, if they were which, you know, facing well-trained, disciplined, and motivated Palestinian fighters, they get killed. They're easily defeated. I think one of the reasons, one of several reasons that we have not yet seen a war with Iran is because the Israeli military knows that a war with Iran will bring about a horrible defeat. And they know that, and that's why they tread very carefully when it comes to, you know, dealing with Iran militarily. So it's not really an army, it's a glorified gang. And what we're seeing is a behavior of gangsters, really. And because, again, they're not held responsible or accountable, they can just, you know, do the stuff that they do on social media.
Okay, thank you. Let's wrap it up with our final questions for the both of you. So, Zachary, what resources would you recommend for us to read or to have access to gain more knowledge about how to engage with Zionists? And there's a lot of questions. I have a Jewish coworker, Zionist colleague. You know, what resources or how do I approach them one-on-one? What exactly do I bring up and references that you can advise us to read so that we are better also prepared to engage with them?
Well, what I would say before sharing some names of individuals who I would recommend or some books or some podcasts that I would recommend would be a very general point about the nature of this country and the nature of the State of Israel, founded on very, very, or at least today, operating according to very, very different set of principles. And I'm not here to pretend like there aren't problems in this country. Of course, there are lots and lots of problems in this country that we need to solve. But there is at least a facade, at least a guiding principle, a North Star, that says everyone's equal before the law. Doesn't matter what your religion is. Doesn't matter what your ethnicity is. Doesn't matter what your race is. In theory, you should be equal before the law. And that should be the starting point for talking to people who are maybe Zionist or maybe Jewish or maybe sympathetic to Zionism, because obviously they believe that to be true. They must believe that in the United States, you should be equal before the law, regardless of whether you're Muslim, Jewish, or Christian. But in Israel, it does not work that way. Not according to the letter of the law. According to the letter of the law, if you know, in Israel proper, you know, within the 48 Palestine, you, if you're a Muslim or a Christian, if you're a Palestinian, you cannot live in one of 900 communities in Israel. You're effectively barred from owning 90% of the country, of the land. I mean, in the United States, it used to be that way as well. Yeah, 65 years ago. Okay? And then in Gaza, you live in a concentration camp. I mean, yeah, you're basically a slave. You can't move anywhere. You have no political rights. You know? So, I mean, do these people not realize that that is exactly, do they want to live in a country where you're divided? Your rights are dependent on what your religion, race, or ethnicity is? Would they want to live in that country? So that's, I think, a good starting point, a good frame of reference for talking to people in this country about Israel-Palestine or Palestine. I think, you know, just to mention some specific people who I think are speak truth to power, who are very insightful. I would mention Francesca Albanese, the UN rapporteur for special human, the UN special rapporteur for human rights in the occupied territories. She's a very powerful voice. I would recommend Ilan Pape, an Israeli historian who speaks very powerfully about the situation. I would recommend Noura Araket and Rashid Khalidi, both scholars on Palestine, of Palestinian heritage. I mean, there's so many powerful voices right now. Ali Abu Nima, Max Blumenthal. I mean, there's so many people who are speaking truth to power. Electronic Intifada has a great live stream. I would recommend Mando Weiss. I would recommend The Gray Zone. I would recommend Amy Goodman's program, Democracy Now. There's so many people. I would obviously recommend all the journalists on the ground, Maryam Barghouti, all the journalists based in Gaza who are talking about the situation, reporting live, telling you what's happening day in, day out. Follow them all. Just have your Zionist colleagues and friends follow the people reporting from the ground. And once you see what's happening on the ground, you know, and you're a human being, then I don't know how that could possibly not change you.
Thank you very much.
I agree 1,000%. I would just add to that, something that gives perspective is to be educated about the history of Palestine pre-1948. Almost always when people refer to the history of Palestine, they go back 1948 or the beginning of the 20th century. There's very little talk about what happened before that. And I'll just say two things about that. One, if you're ever in Virginia, if anybody's ever been to Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's estate, has anybody been there, visited there? When you walk into Thomas Jefferson's home, in the foyer of the house, there's a big map of Africa that his father drew. His father was a cartographer, I believe. And if you look at that massive map, it's the entire wall. If you look slightly north and east, there's a stretch of land, and there's these big black letters. Guess what it says? It says Palestine. Mm. So nobody mentions that. People say, you know, Palestine has been Palestine going back a very long time. So it's really important. You know, Palestine was a flourishing country. Europeans and others did trade with Palestine. They were importing cotton and oil and barley and so and all kinds of, you know, things that were being imported from Palestine. There was a rich political life and cultural life and so on. And there's a great Palestinian writer who wrote a couple of historical novels that I always recommend. His name is Ibrahim Nasrallah. And you can read it in Arabic if you read Arabic, or they've been translated. And check out Ibrahim Nasrallah. He's got two very, very, really excellent, my favorite historical novels. One is called The Time of White Horses. And the other one, and it's about a single village from the Ottoman days to 1948. And the other one historically precedes that period, and it's called The Lanterns of the King of Galilee. And it's a historic novel about a Palestinian figure that is very important Palestinian leader by the name of Zahir al-Umar. And he basically governed Palestine throughout the 18th century. Nobody knows about these people. Nobody knows about these things. And so if you like literature, Ibrahim Nasrallah is a great writer. But these novels, I always recommend them because they give context, historical context. Oh, and there's one more, which is a historian by the name of Nur Masalha. And Nur Masalha is a Palestinian historian. And the book that I recommend is called Palestine, a 4,000-year history. And it gives you a 4,000-year history, not mythology, not biblical stories. History that basically demonstrates how that land was referred to as Palestine going back to the pharaohs. And he shows how each and every empire that ruled the region referred to it as Palestine and how Palestine evolved. So I would add that just to give historical context, because otherwise people get lost in the Zionist arguments that it was always Israel. And the Jews have a right to return and all of that, which is that called nonsense, and I agree. And so I would just add that to the list.
Thank you very much. So, brothers and sisters, as we wrap up, I think what just happened a few days ago in Amsterdam actually serves as a illustrative example of how collectively we can make a difference and impact broader society. For those of you that are not aware, a soccer match between an Israeli team and others. It turned into just a bunch of hooligans. The Israeli fans went and they're the ones that started it. Video footage is very clear. They started attacking the Palestinian flag, attacking even people on the street, punching them. And obviously, when that happens, you know, the other side, a lot of Moroccans, a lot of Palestinians, a lot of Arabs, a lot of regular people just got involved and started pushing back and defending themselves. Initially, a number of news outlets actually reported quite factually that the Israeli fans were chanting death to the Arabs, the Israeli fans were desecrating Palestinian flags, and then, you know, a riot broke out and they attacked and then they were attacked back. SubhanAllah, amazingly, not surprisingly, a number of these channels then withdrew this report and released a counter report. And the counter report was blatantly spinning this as a, I kid you not, the word pogrom was used, right? Although nobody lost their lives. With the word anti-Semitism was thrown around everywhere, constantly that, the Palestinians are attacking the Israelis, this is happening in the heart of Europe. Unbelievably, as if synchronized, coordinated, our president, Canada's president, you know, England's, you know, prime minister, multiple leaders gave very similar statements about, you know, we decry the rise of anti-Semitism. But social media did not remain quiet. And average people, users, you and us, everybody, they just got active and began showing video footage, began pushing back. So much so that a number of mainstream media outlets had to withdraw the second report and basically put a pause on the story and release a third version. And what this shows is that collectively we can make a difference. And this is where we want to conclude here. I know we feel so demoralized. I know the sentiment is as if, how can this ever end? Yet there are victories everywhere we see. We heard statistics of like a large group of even Jewish Americans are changing their mind. The youngsters now, the younger generation now, they're understanding this reality. We're in this battle for the long run. It might not be an immediate victory. And the Quran reminds us, وَلَا تَهِنُوا وَلَا تَعْزَنُوا وَأَنْتُمُ الْأَعْلَوْنَ إِن كُنْتُمْ مُؤْمِنِينَ. Do not give up and do not falter, and you shall be victorious if you have faith. And the Quran reminds us, in يَنْصُرْكُمُ اللَّهُ فَلَا غَالِبَ لَكُمْ. If Allah helps you, then none can overcome you. And if you do not seek Allah's help, well then, you have none to blame but yourselves. Do not falter, do not give up. Every small victory is going to lead into the larger victory. I understand, we feel, what can we possibly do? Hearing these numbers, AIPAC spent $100 million. $100 million. But you know what? They might have money, but they don't have the truth. Truth is on our side. Facts are on our side. They cannot spin the truth forever. So keep on doing what we're doing. Keep on spreading the word. Keep on spreading compassion and love and mercy. Keep on changing the hearts and minds of the people. And slowly but surely, we're going to see from this chaos, inshallah ta'ala, peace will come out. There shall be a free Palestine. There shall be a free Gaza. There shall be a free Masjid al-Aqsa. And our goal is to be a part of that process. And I want to conclude, I'll say this directly in front of our guests over here. And I'm sorry if I put you on the spot or make you feel a little embarrassed, but it needs to be said here. These two guests of ours, if they don't inspire you, if they don't call, they spoke the truth at great personal cost. We just heard they lost their friends and their families. We just heard their families are not even speaking to them. And yet here they are speaking the truth. What excuse do we have? What is our excuse for not standing up and doing what we can? If they don't inspire you, then who else is going to inspire you? So do not be scared. Do not be coward. Stand up. Preach the truth. Stand up and influence people. Be brave. Be armed with knowledge. Know what to say. And keep on doing this. And inshallah ta'ala, slowly but surely, we shall see victory. We have no doubt. Ala inna nasrallahi qareeb. Ala inna nasrallahi qareeb. We have no doubt about this. So keep on doing what we're doing. Make dua to Allah. Do not lose hope in what we are doing. Put your trust in our Lord. And inshaAllah ta'ala, we shall see a free Gaza in our lifetimes. Jazakumullahu khairan for all of you. And especially to our guests here. Please welcome, stand up and welcome our guests here. We really thank them for all. And as I say, I express the sentiment. I understand you lost family and friends, but all of us are your family and friends. We're all here for you. Anything you need. Thank you very much on our behalf. And we hope, inshallah, anytime you come, we're always going to be here. Thank you very much. Alhamdulillah.
إن الله وملائكته يصلون على النبي يا أيها الذين آمنوا صلوا عليه وسلموا تسليماً